Christian Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Nuns, Where They Came From, Who They Are, and Where They Are Going, by Ryan P. Burge, narrated by Jim Dennison. Publisher's Note: In this audio edition, you will hear references to figures present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Preface: Two facts will help place this book in a proper context. I have been pastoring American Baptist churches for the past 15 years, and I also have a PhD in political science, having published 15 articles in peer-reviewed academic journals. What that means is that I have constantly straddled the world of faith and academia. I realize that makes me pretty atypical. I'm no fun at dinner parties because I refuse to talk about my work as a pastor or an academic in a social setting. Way too many landmines. But it does make me pretty well suited to present data about American religion to pastors. More specifically, I think it makes me an ideal voice to write about one of the most important shifts that has occurred over the last 40 years in American religion, the rise of the religiously unaffiliated. As a pastor who is also an academic, I have firsthand knowledge of the power of statistics for people of faith. I have written dozens of pieces for Christianity Today, Religion News Service, and Barna Group that are all grounded in data and receive an overwhelmingly positive response from a variety of audiences. Unfortunately, as powerful as statistics are, I can't tell you how many sermons I've heard, books I've read, and tweets I've seen in the past few years from well-meaning pastors that are just not statistically accurate. Pastors are supposed to be in the business of preaching the truth about not only Jesus Christ, but also the social world, but a lot of them need to stay in their lane. Let me be clear. I don't blame pastors for wanting to use statistics to try to make a point about how church membership is in decline and the religiously unaffiliated are becoming an increasingly important factor in American religion. Pastors want to leave their flock with one thing they can discuss when they sit down for lunch after church, and a good data point sticks in the brain in a way few other things do. People want to have unbiased facts explained in a way that they can understand. Pastors need to be steady sources of accurate information. But unfortunately, some of them aren't taking the time to fact-check everything that goes into the weekly sermon. However, one of the most valuable things I learned in graduate school was how little I, and all of us, know about most of the world, which is why data in untrained hands can be a dangerous thing. Just as I wouldn't want one of my political science colleagues to try to explain the evolution of Trinitarian thought in Protestant Christianity, I don't want pastors to try to explain how Karl Marx thought about religion or expound on the implications of internet-based polling. At the same time, as I learned to be humble about what I don't know, I also learned to speak confidently in areas to which I have devoted years of study. Charting the course of American religion for the past 5 decades has been my life's work up to this point. Still, being a quantitative social scientist as well as a pastor often puts me in an awkward position. Sometimes I am asked to present my work to denominational leaders. Inevitably, during the question and answer time, someone in the audience will bring up a particularly thorny topic and want me to weigh in on it. I almost always preface my response by asking, "Would you like me to answer that as a pastor or as a quantitative social scientist?" In this book, I try to do both. I live in the data, creating charts and graphs almost every day. But in between recoding variables and specifying regression models, I carve out time to work on my sermon or visit one of my members in the hospital. My focus over the last few years has been twofold: publishing enough to earn tenure at my university and helping pastors and denominational leaders understand the world around them a bit better. My goal is to take all the education I have had in the social sciences to make the theory comprehensible and the data accessible. So, pastors and committed lay leaders, consider this book a resource to get it right when talking about American religion, A little cheat sheet for your work. Introduction. It all started with a tweet. A lot of social scientists I follow on social media were noting that the General Social Survey, GSS, had just released the raw data from the 2018 wave, and scholars were already cranking out quick analyses of some of the top-line changes in American political and religious life. For social scientists who study religion, the GSS is the most important survey instrument for analyzing changes in American society. It's the gold standard in measuring religious change in America. That's largely because the GSS has been asking the same religion questions in essentially the same way since its creation in 1972. If a researcher wants to know what share of Americans never attended church in the 1980s, the GSS is the place to go. As soon as I read the news, I immediately downloaded the cumulative data file and started doing some analysis. My primary objective was simple. I wanted to know how the seven major religious traditions in the United States had shifted over the previous 2 years. I had already published several pieces about religious measurement, so I had all the code I needed stored on my hard drive. All I had to do was run it on the updated data file and visualize the results. But by the time I had gotten home from work, my two boys needed dinner and a bath. I could hardly contain myself, so I moved quickly. As soon as both of them had filled their bellies with peanut butter and jelly and were happily playing in a bubble bath, I bounded down the stairs to my office and ran the more than 200 lines of computer code that would calculate the size of all seven religious traditions in every survey year of the GSS dating back to the early 1970s. And I saw it immediately. The percentage of religiously unaffiliated people had steadily risen since the early 1990s. Previously, the nuns had zoomed past 10% of the population by 1996, crossed the 15% threshold just a decade later, and managed to reach 20% by 2014. That rise has not abated in 2018. It had finally happened. The nuns were now the same size as both Roman Catholics and Evangelical Protestants. That meant that the religiously unaffiliated were statistically the same size as the largest religious groups in the United States. I had to let the world know. But I was on a time crunch. My boys were starting to get restless in the bathtub. So I quickly put together a graph, picked a pre-made color scheme, and added the names of each religious tradition to the visualization. I wrote up a quick caption, noted that there was some big news about the religiously unaffiliated, and hit the tweet button. I went back upstairs to get my boys ready for bed, helped them get pajamas on, brushed their teeth, and read a quick bedtime story before lights out. Then I looked down at my phone. The graph had already been retweeted nearly 100 times. It was going viral. What followed was one of the busiest periods of my life. Before this, I had spoken to 2 or 3 reporters in my entire academic career. Now I was fielding 2 or 3 interview requests per day. That one simple graph took on a life of its own. It was picked up by most major media outlets in the United States, including the New York Times and the Washington Post, and it landed on the front page of CNN's website. Reporters from Europe were intrigued, and the story ended up in the Times and the Daily Mail. It made the front page of Reddit, receiving over 36,000 upvotes and over 2,000 comments. I appeared on C-SPAN on Easter Sunday. Journalists, podcasters, and pastors were all asking me the same questions. How did this happen? And what does this mean for the future of American religion? I didn't know it at the time, but my entire life had led me to this moment. My career path has been a bit unusual. While I have been a quantitative social scientist for over a decade, I have also been in Christian ministry since just after my 20th birthday. Wrestling with questions about the future of American religion is not just some cold and calculated academic exercise for me. It's something I experience every Sunday when I get behind the pulpit. I grew up Southern Baptist, My mother was a Sunday school teacher, and my father drove the church bus. My grandmother was the church secretary, and my grandfather was an usher. We went to church every time the doors were open. I was the kid who was there every Sunday morning and Sunday night. When I entered junior high, the youth group of First Baptist Church of Salem, Illinois, became my home away from home. I went to as many church camps, youth rallies, spaghetti fundraisers, and lock-ins as I could. As I moved into high school, I began to lead Bible studies for the younger kids. I was all in. During the spring of my sophomore year of college, I was confronted with a problem. I didn't have a summer job lined up. Through a series of seemingly random events, I became aware that a church just 20 miles from my hometown wanted a youth ministry intern for the summer. I applied, was interviewed, and accepted the job at the tender age of 20. I had no idea what I was doing. That three-month internship turned into a three-year position that I left only after I decided I wanted to pursue a graduate degree in political science. In graduate school, I began pastoring a small church of about 30 retirees. A year later, I was called by First Baptist Church of Mount Vernon, Illinois. 13 years later, I am still behind the pulpit. I constantly wonder how all of this happened. While at First Baptist, I finished a master's thesis, got married, bought a house, defended my dissertation, and had two children. And my church went from having about 50 people in the pews to just over 20. What was happening in American religion was also happening right in front of me. This book is an effort to understand and explain how the number of religiously unaffiliated went from no more than a rounding error to nearly a quarter of the U.S. population. While others have tried to make these seismic changes about doctrine and dogma, that's not the approach I will be taking. Instead, I will use both the theory and methodological tools put forth by social science to explore what demographic, religious, and political factors have and are giving rise to the nuns. My work is unapologetically quantitative. That means you will hear of a lot of charts and graphs throughout these sections. Here's why I think that's essential. No one can accurately conceptualize what American religion looks like today, let alone what it looked like 30 years ago. We all live in our own social, cultural, and religious bubbles. The human mind often clings to anecdotes that represent the extreme cases, not the average ones. It's nearly impossible for any one individual to have a high-level view of American religion. While surveys are not foolproof, and we will discuss some of their flaws in just a few moments, they are one of the only ways to generate an objective assessment of people's beliefs and behavior over time. If you are scared off by math, there's nothing to fear. I have taken great care to present simplified visualizations that are not based on complicated statistical models. More often than not, I am just doing simple arithmetic. A lot of social scientists seem to forget how much we can learn by simply counting things. However, if you are still struggling to understand a graph, the text will explain the visualization. I am going to point out findings you may have missed, and I will use the text to provide some additional information about the visualization. The data for this work comes from a variety of sources that I have collected and organized over the course of my academic studies. Two primary surveys will appear frequently. The aforementioned GSS is an invaluable resource when looking at religious trends that stretch back for decades. However, the smaller sample size of the GSS can create problems related to statistical uncertainty. The Cooperative Congressional Election Study, CCES, is huge in comparison. While the 2016 wave of the GSS contained about 3,000 respondents, the CCES conducted in the same year had a total sample size of 64,000. Despite its tremendous survey sample, however, the CCES suffers from one major problem. It was not created until 2006. Therefore, doing long-term trend analysis is not possible. The structure of the book is as follows. The first chapter is a deep dive into the seven religious traditions that are identified by scholars of American religion. I describe each tradition in broad strokes and track the change in its size over the past 4.5 decades, explaining why the religiously unaffiliated have risen in the United States will be the aim of the second chapter. Topics of discussion here will include grand theories of social science, issues with survey methodology, and the rise of the Internet. The remainder of the book will be focused on sketching the outlines of the three types of religious nuns: atheists, agnostics, and those who identify as nothing in particular. Finally, the book will end with a discussion of the future of American religion. My aim here is to direct pastors and denominational leaders to think about ways to respond to the rise of the nuns by understanding which factors can't be changed in American society and which ones can. One of the lessons I try to impart to my students is that the role of a social scientist is not to describe the world as we wish it were or hope it could be, but instead to describe it as it actually exists. That's my goal here. The data will be my guide, and providing simple and clear explanation will be my focus. I am reminded of the words of St. Paul when he wrote, "For now we see in a mirror dimly." See 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 12. It's my hope that after this book, the mirror will be slightly more illuminated. Chapter 1. What does the American religious landscape look like? It's always amazing to me how people spend thousands of hours and millions of dollars on just classifying things. For instance, in late 2018, scientists from more than 60 countries around the globe met in Versailles, France, faced with an unbelievably important problem: defining how much a kilogram weighed. The reference measure was literally a block of metal that was held under glass. The International Bureau of Weights and Measures chose that hunk of material to be a kilogram, a reference that is used untold millions of times a day around the globe. But they were facing a problem. The kilogram no longer weighed a kilogram. It was losing its mass very slowly over time. The reference was no longer accurate, and science had to make a change. They eventually adopted a resolution to move to a more precise and consistent measurement. In the United States, there's an entire industry that has cropped up called tariff engineering. Those who engage in this practice try to convince the United States Court of International Trade that a raw material, a children's toy, or any other item imported into the country should be placed in a different classification in the U.S. tax code. For instance, several costume companies sued the federal government because some of the higher-end Santa Claus suits that they had imported were being taxed as fancy dress instead of a festive costume, which resulted in their having to pay millions of dollars in additional taxes to the government. After a 2-year legal process, the court ruled that the Santa Claus suits were, in fact, fancy dress and must be taxed at the higher rate. Being a researcher who studies American religion often feels like being a tariff engineer or a scientist trying to decide what a kilogram actually means. Except in our case, the hunk of metal or expensive Santa costume actually has very strong opinions about its place in the world as well. It's like trying to define a bowl of gelatin after it has been mixed and it sits in the refrigerator. By the time you have come up to a consensus on a term for the bowl of neon green soup, it's become something else entirely. That's not to say that social science hasn't done its best to try to nail down a definition of religious affiliation, because it has. Beginning in the 1990s, a group of political scientists who were pioneering the study of American religion and politics began to articulate a classification scheme that became known as the 3 B's: religious behavior, religious belief, and religious belonging. It bears noting that several of the authors of this typology were themselves evangelical Protestants, and so had likely sat through hundreds of sermons that were structured around 3 central points that all began with the same letter of the alphabet. Each of the B's has its own set of theoretical and methodological strengths and weaknesses. The 3 B's. Behavior. Religious behavior is tangible evidence of an individual's faith. For instance, it takes no leap in logic to assume that someone who attends church several times a week is more likely religious than an individual who attends only when she visits her grandmother every few years. However, church attendance is not the only dimension on which social scientists measure religious behavior. Things like how frequently an individual prays, how often or how much they donate to their church, or if they try to convert their friends and neighbors to their flavor of religion, are all forms of religious behavior. From a social science standpoint, using church attendance as a measure of religiosity makes sense. If someone says that they are Catholic but attend Mass only once a year, they will much less likely be exposed to the theology and the religious culture of Catholicism than someone who is a faithful weekly attender. On the other hand, religious behavior, especially church attendance, is not without its deficiencies. For instance, many incredibly devout elderly people are physically unable to attend services, which means that they would score lower on a religiosity index. Another issue with using religious behavior to rate religious devotion is that some religions place a greater emphasis on attendance than others. For instance, evangelical and Mormon culture strongly encourage it, but it is not so important among Hindus or Buddhists. Also, religious behavior measures may undercount people who have moved to a new area and haven't found a church where they feel comfortable yet, or people who have young children whom they may not want to fight to keep quiet during a worship service. Belief. Religious belief is what most people think about when they are asked to describe the goal of religion. I have heard many people state very forcefully that there is only one real reason to go to church, and that is to strengthen one's relationship with the divine. This viewpoint presupposes a faith that is completely vertical in orientation. That faith is about an individual's relationship with God, and largely writes off the relationship one can have with other people in the congregation. From this perspective, the way an individual thinks is the most important dimension for social scientists to measure. The question most often used to measure religious belief relates to an individual's view of a holy text. For instance, the General Social Survey, GSS, asks respondents which of three statements comes closest to describing their thoughts about the Bible. The Bible is the actual Word of God and is to be taken literally, word for word. The Bible is the inspired Word of God, but not everything in it should be taken literally, word for word. The Bible is an ancient book of fables, legends, history, and moral precepts recorded by men. Biblical literalism has become a proxy for a whole host of conservative religious beliefs. However, this measure is also incredibly problematic. The primary reason is that it is biased against people who don't practice Protestant Christianity. While there are many devout Catholics in the United States, the official position of the Catholic Church is not biblical literalism, but instead that the Bible should be interpreted in light of the Church's teachings on different theological issues. Therefore, many theologically conservative Catholics do not classify themselves as literalists and therefore are not counted as having high levels of religiosity, although they might be very religious by other measures. In addition, dozens of other faith groups, including Jews, Muslims, and those of Eastern faith traditions, have a difficult time answering a question about the Bible. While other questions have been used to measure an individual's religious belief, like asking about the existence of Satan, an afterlife, or evil in the world, many of them fall prey to the same issues that plague the question about biblical literalism. They are specific to one type of Christianity. Belonging. The final B is that of religious belonging, which is one that will be used as a unit of analysis in the remainder of this chapter. One of the primary problems that social science has to face is this: how do people know who they are and what they are about? That is, how do people orient themselves in social space? How do they define who may be friendly and who could be potentially hostile? One way people do this is by setting down markers, both visible and invisible, denoting what types of groups they want to affiliate with and what groups they see as undesirable. Think about someone who wears a camouflage shirt, even when they are not going out to hunt, or a man who wears a suit and tie to a wedding where others are wearing blue jeans. Some people proudly display their political affiliation on the bumper of their car, while others make it clear who they voted for by the content they share on their Facebook page. These are subtle ways for people to signal to others who they are and what type of people they would like to associate with. A social scientist who uses religious belonging to sort people into categories does so based on the notion that religion is a decidedly social affair and that choosing a religious group is an intentional way of anchoring oneself in the social, religious, and political world in which they live. The preeminent political scientists Larry Bartels and Christopher Aiken contend that people's driving principle as they move through life is, what would people like me do in a given situation? That includes at the ballot box, in the pews, or on social media. If this is the proper way to understand the social world, then the primary question that social science has to answer is, how do individuals pick who are like them? I would argue that religion is an ideal way, an incredibly visible one, for citizens to orient themselves as part of the social world. Consider this. There may be no more easily malleable demographic factor in American life than one's religious affiliation. For the vast majority of Americans, concepts like race and gender are incredibly concrete and fixed. For most, education is a pursuit that occurs only during a short period of their lives, and while one's income can drastically fall due to downsizing or recession, that usually is not followed by a drastic change in social or political behavior. Age is obviously a function of time. Other things like a change in marital status may happen once or twice, and people become parents just a handful of times. Religion doesn't work like that. None of the demographic factors just mentioned can be changed as easily as religious affiliation. As an example, consider someone who took a survey a year ago and noted that they were Presbyterian. But when they were asked the same question about religion this week, they indicated that they had no religious affiliation. Did their actual religious behavior change dramatically between last year and now? More than likely, the answer is no. What is more plausible is that they were rarely attending services before and still clung to that religious identity. But for reasons that can never be completely understood, they made the conscious choice to say in the most recent survey that they have no current religious affiliation. It required not a conversation with their pastor or a public pronouncement to their friends and family, but instead just a subtle shift in their mind from seeing themselves as a Protestant Christian to someone who has no attachment to any religious group. That one simple shift can be indicative of a tremendous amount of change in the way that person thinks about their place in the world. So how do social scientists sort the menagerie of religious affiliations into categories that are not so broad that they lose all conceptual clarity or so large that they would be impossible to easily remember? The most widely adopted system in use today is called RELTRAD. It was developed by a team of social scientists nearly two decades ago as a way to sort individuals in the GSS into different religious classifications. It's fair to say that no one, including the creators of RELTRAD, loves the classification scheme. However, its usage has become pervasive in American social science, with dozens of peer-reviewed books and articles using the typology every year. It's the best that we have. Here's how it works. It takes a series of questions about religious affiliation in the GSS and places each specific religious tradition in one of seven categories: Evangelical Protestant, Mainline Protestant, Black Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Observant of Other Faith Traditions, and Non-Affiliated. Those seven categories are what I will discuss in some detail in the remainder of this chapter. But first, I want to provide a broad sense of what American religion has looked like over the past 46 years.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?